Welcome to Earth Matters, environmental justice stories from Australia and around the world. On Wurundjeri country in Melbourne and broadcast across this continent via the Community Radio Network. I'm Tishan Ahern. Today, we hear from American biologist and author Sandra Steingraber, giving the keynote address to the Permanent People's Tribunal session on human rights, fracking and climate change. Sandra takes a lyrical look at the interconnections between molecules, organisms, ecosystems, logistics and capitalism in the story of fracking.
What an honour to serve as the opening keynote speaker for the historic Permanent People's Tribunal session on human rights, fracking, and climate change. The Permanent People's Tribunal is an august international forum. Its origin story is as an investigation of human rights breaches during the war in Vietnam. Since then, its hearings have examined abridgments of human rights standards in Bhopal, India, in the Ukrainian city of Chernobyl, and most recently among the Rohingya and Kachin refugees of Myanmar. Today, we've begun an exploration into the potential human rights violation of a newish technology called unconventional high-volume hydraulic fracturing combined with horizontal drilling, so-called fracking for short. Fracking is what the industry calls it, and fracking is what the enemies of that industry both call it. Fracking is a technology developed at the end of the 20th century in sparsely populated western regions of the United States, using public money from taxpayers. In a line, fracking turns fresh water into a poisonous club to smash apart shale bedrock in order to extract otherwise unattainable bubbles of oil or natural gas, methane, trapped inside of that rock. Fracking has since spread east, west, north and south, including to the densely populated regions of the Northeast where I live, and to Southern California, and to the breadbasket of Midwestern agricultural regions. The dramatic increase in fracking over the past decade in the United States has pushed oil and gas extraction operations into heavily populated areas. At least 6% of the U.S. population, 17.6 million Americans, now live within a mile of an active oil or gas well, a number that includes 1.4 million children and 1.1 million elderly people. At least 8.6 million people are served by drinking water source located less than a mile from a well pad. These facts alone, along with emerging evidence revealing that fracking sites and associated fracking infrastructure are disproportionately sited in non-white, low-income, and indigenous communities, both in the United States and in countries like Argentina, Mexico, and Canada, where fracking has been exported, means that it is right and necessary to understand the potential for human exposures and accompanying adverse impacts, not only as an issue of public health, but fundamentally as an issue of human rights. My frame for this keynote tonight is the biologist Rachel Carson, whose 1962 book Silent Spring, about the unintended consequences of pesticides like DDT, sparked a revolution in environmental consciousness and is rightly credited as a founding force of American environmentalism. Carson makes clear that the environmental crisis is first and foremost a crisis of human rights. And it's that element of her writing that I want to foreground and embrace for our purposes tonight. Her panoramic language that takes us from crop dusters into groundwater and into the nucleus of cells is an artistic exploration in which language becomes a cinematic camera, showing us the connections in the natural world that are otherwise invisible to us. So I want to take a Carsonesque approach tonight and speak to you first as a creative writer and use language as a camera to take you down into the dark heart of the planet, into the bedrock that lies beneath our feet. And I want to rewrite for you as a landscape, that this bedrock of our nation is not a void, a lifeless place of inertia, darkness, with oil and gas pocked inside the rock, but rather it is a living ecosystem, a subterranean coral reef, if you will, that is teeming with life, a habitat that is animate and beautiful and is connected to the carbon cycle via metabolizing organisms who live there and thus is connected to us here at the sunlit surface. Rachel Carson reminds us that wars waged against the web of life will sooner or later transform the cells of our own bodies into battlefields. And this is also true when we turn the weapons of destruction against our nation's bedrock. So let's begin here. 400 million years ago, shallow seas overlay parts of the North American continent. One of them was in the part of the world that I live in the Northeast. And the shallow ocean extended from approximately where the Catskill Mountain Range now is all the way to the middle of Ohio. And I, who live in the Finger Lakes region of upstate New York, would have lived along its northern banks of the sea. The southern reach went all the way into West Virginia. The ocean floor became a graveyard of the organisms who lived here. And remember, 400 million years ago was before fur, before backbones, before 3- and 4-chambered hearts, before breasts, before eyeballs, before fins and flippers. So the organisms we're talking about who lived here were sea lilies, squid, diatoms, and plankton. And when they died, they fell to the bottom of the sea. And that ocean began to fill with silt because it was surrounded by mountains. And as the mountains eroded, they turned into dust. And dust changes its name when it falls into water, and then we call it silt. Mountains are full of entire periodic charts of elements. So as these mountain ranges eroded, the elements drifted with the silt into the bottom of the ocean. These are things like barium, strontium, uranium, lead, mercury. And so these elements became part of the floor of these shallow seas. So the organisms died, and they fell to the ground, to the bottom of the ocean by gravity. But because the Earth's atmosphere wasn't as oxygenated 400 million years ago as it is now, there were not yet land plants. The organisms didn't have enough oxygen to completely decompose, so instead they turned into bubbles of methane, which is carbon with 4 hydrogens, or a heavier hydrocarbon molecule, something that we would call petroleum or oil. And so not just across the Northeast, but also in North Dakota, in California, in Oklahoma, and Texas, these similar oceans existed at similar times. And these phenomenon went on. So eventually then these corpses were covered over by the silt that fell upon them, and they were buried. And eventually then the whole ocean floor petrified and turned from silt into shale. And these organisms were then trapped as bubbles of oil or natural gas inside the rock itself. And they've stayed there like that for 400 million years. Those hydrocarbon bubbles of oil and gas are the quarry of fracking. But these ancient ocean floors that became our shale bedrock are not just a graveyard. They're also a living ecosystem. They're inhabited by living organisms now. Some are bacteria, but many others occupy an ancient domain of life called archaea. And these organisms feed on the hydrocarbons that are down there. They also, some of them, feed on radioactive decay. They're strange. They have, some of them, arsenic instead of phosphorus in their DNA. And now I'm just going to speak to my fellow biologists in the room. Which is very unusual for organisms. We don't see that in living things who live here on the Earth's surface. And the way they can avoid oxidative stress without an electron transport system is that they actually send electrons out into the surrounding rock. They're organized into colonies in order to do this. And they use nanowires to send across themselves large number of electrons, and thus they alter the rock and change it from one element to another. So I want to pause here for a minute and make a kind of theological or philosophical query. What I'm saying is that the biologic is the creator of the abiotic. These organisms are down there a mile below our feet, making rock, altering it and reshaping it and turning it into something else. And altogether, geologists believe that these deep life organisms by a biomass actually exceed the biomass of living things here on the sunlit surface of our planet. That's why I say we need to think of our bedrock as a kind of subterranean coral reef, another world down there that we may not know much about, but whose destruction and poisoning may have consequences for us. So fracking uses water, 2 to 20 million gallons per frack job, and sends it down into that shale by drilling straight down into it and then turning the drill bit sideways and tunneling like a robotic mole for another mile or more. And first we send down explosives into that tunnel to start fracturing the shale. But what really widens those cracks is water. So fresh drinking water is then sent down the hole. Water is not compressible under high pressure. And you can imagine what kind of pressures are required, because the lithostatic pressure of the earth pressing down on the shale a mile or more of substrate above the shale bedrock has to, in order to blow that up down there, water has to be under immense amounts of pressure. And if it were only water that was used as the agent for fracking, it wouldn't work, because as soon as you release the pressure to let the gas flow out, all of the fractures that you create, you turn the bedrock into shards at this point. They would all close up again as the weight of the earth presses down upon them. So instead, sand is added to fracking fluid, and not just any kind of sand, but silica sand, because the grains of silica sand are shaped in such a way that they resist crushing under immense pressure. So really, the water is used to create the fractures, but also to shoot the sand grains into the cracks created. And like tiny doorstops, they hold open those spaces so the bubble of oil or gas can then escape and go up the borehole after the pressure is released. But in order to get sand down the hole and around the bend without settling out and clogging the pipe, you need to thicken that water with gelling agents to move the sand around the bend and shoot it into the cracks. So gelling agents are added to fracking fluid, along with things like friction reducers and anti-scaling agents. But those living organisms, those bacteria and those archaea that are down there at that depth, will feed on those gelling agents, and they'll grow inside the pipes and interfere with the flow of gas. And so powerful biocides are added, like glutaraldehyde, to fracking fluid, which is why it's so toxic, because we have to engage in a mass extermination campaign, an underground pesticide spraying program of the bedrock, in order for fracking to work.
You're listening to Earth Matters, environmental justice stories on the Community Radio Network. Today, we're hearing from biologist and author Sandra Steingraber, as she uses lyrical prose to draw together the web of life that fracking is disrupting.
And some of the water that's used to liberate the bubbles of oil and gas remain trapped within the fractured zone, and as such has now been permanently removed from the hydrologic cycle, forever entombed among the fractured shards. And so what does it mean that we're making water disappear in a time of a climate crisis when lack of availability of fresh water is getting more insecure? The water used to fracture shale will never again flow as a river, never again rise as mist, never again rise as sap, never become nectar, attracting bees, never again blood plasma or breast milk or tears or cerebral spinal fluid or the breath of our exhaled lungs on a cold winter day, or never the snowflakes on that day. Some of the water travels back up to the surface. That's called flowback fluid. And it contains not only the chemical additives that were used to turn the water into fracking fluid, but also it now contains brine, heavy metals, radioactive elements, all those things that were deposited by the eroding of ancient mountain ranges that are now inside the shale, toxic elements that wouldn't hurt anyone as long as they're trapped down below, but now we're going to bring them up to the surface. The result is a massive amount of poisonous liquid waste, and we have a problem with no solution because no technology exists to turn fracking waste back into drinkable water. Its safe containment is for eternity. It could be reused to frack another well, but not unless it's highly diluted, because the more you use it, the more salty and toxic and corrosive it becomes. So the practice is to inject it in other deep wells where it has been definitively linked to earthquakes, because fracking fluid contains anti-friction agents. Remember, a fracking borehole is only about 5 inches or so in diameter, and to shoot that vast amounts of water with that kind of pressure, you need to reduce the friction. So you make the fracking fluid very slippery. But if you then inject it back down into the earth, it lubricates fault lines and allows rock formations to slip past each other, and that's how earthquakes are generated. We have absolute proof about this link. So this raises to me another ethical question about generational inequity. How is it right that this generation of people alive now can liquidate the bedrock and enjoy the profits from the oil and gas that we blow the bedrock up to extract, and then produce toxic waste which must be curated eternally by our children and grandchildren, who will receive none of the profits? But I want to widen the lens now and take an even bigger view of fracking, because it really doesn't start with the drill bit screwing into the ground. It starts in the upper Midwest with the mining of frack sand. Frack sand mining has now become the number one export of the state of Wisconsin, more than cheese. So Wisconsin is exporting itself, and it's changing its landscape to do that. The coulees and hills and bluff of Wisconsin are disappearing. They're made of sandstone, and that sandstone is made of grains of silica sand that are hot in high demand for fracking. So you have all these frack sand mining operations going on in Minnesota and Iowa and Wisconsin and in my part of the world in downstate Illinois, where I grew up. Silica sand makes silica dust, and silica dust, like asbestos, is linked to lung cancer. It's also linked to silicosis. So although the people in the upper Midwest live far from the fracking fields, their bedrock is being extracted and blown apart to be carted off to the place in the world where I now live, to be shoved into the ground, to hold open the cracks in the destroyed bedrock of the Northeast, or taken to the fracking fields in the Bakken Shale of North Dakota or Colorado. And then where does the gas go or the oil go after it comes out of the ground? Well, there is a massive amount of infrastructure involved to take that oil and gas from the point of its extraction to wherever the burner tip is. And that takes the form of pipelines and compressor stations and hundreds of underground and above ground gas and oil storage facilities. And here in the Northwest, LNG facilities. where natural gas, through the energy-intensive process of cryogenics, is super-chilled, so it can be loaded onto tankers and taken to places where pipelines can't run, such as across the ocean. And of course, the story doesn't end there, because methane leaks at every step of this process. From the moment the drill bit goes into the ground and contacts the shale, methane is pouring out of the hole. It pours out of the valves of every single pipeline, of every single compressor station along the way. And the result is that methane is being loaded into the atmosphere. Methane, 86 times more powerful than carbon dioxide at being able to trap heat in our atmosphere. More methane leaks from fracking operations than we previously appreciated, which means natural gas via fracking is not any cleaner for the climate than coal, and it may be worse. Methane emissions are 20 to 60% higher than previously thought. The ongoing surge in methane levels are now driving climate impacts, and the sharp uptick in global methane levels since 2006 is largely attributable to fossil fuel extraction processes, notably fracking. So let's pause here for a minute and consider these molecules of methane in the atmosphere and remind ourselves that carbon, when we talk about decarbonizing and loading the atmosphere with carbon, carbon is not the first name for carbon dioxide. Carbon comes in two flavors, carbon dioxide and methane. And these are two naturally occurring components of our Earth that actually make life on Earth possible. So let's just pause for a moment and consider that. So methane comes from dead things. Carbon dioxide is our exhaled breath of all living things. And both of these molecules have the ability, when struck by thermal radiation, which is heat, to vibrate. So when methane and carbon dioxide are in our atmosphere, and then the Earth's surface turns away from the sun at night, the light from the sun, the light energy, entirely vanishes. But the heat energy does not entirely vanish. If it did, it would be like the Disney movie Frozen. Our oceans would turn into ice rinks every night. Our blood plasma would freeze stiff. That doesn't happen because two molecules, methane and CO2, when the sun's heat energy bounces off the surface of the Earth and bounces back into the atmosphere and encounters a molecule of CO2 or methane, those molecules begin to vibrate, and their vibration traps the heat. That's what we mean when we say it's a greenhouse heat-trapping gas. So these vibrational molecules all dancing all night long up in the sky prevent us from dying every night. So the living, the exhaled breath, and the dead, the living and the dead conspire together to make life possible on Earth. So good that we have greenhouse gases. And by the way, of the two molecules, CO2 lasts longer in our atmosphere than methane. Methane is more potent at trapping heat, but it will fall apart after about a decade, whereas CO2 goes on trapping heat for a century, which means your exhaled breath will outlive you. You will be dead and gone, but your breathing, your whole lifetime of breathing, has changed the chemistry of the atmosphere, and those molecules of your exhaled breath, representing all the things you did to metabolize all your life, will go on trapping heat for the people and all the living organisms, all of our relatives, to come after us. And of course, you know, through the miracle of photosynthesis, that some of that CO2 will be taken out of the atmosphere by our friends, the plants, who take them through their stomata of their leaves. Remember that in seventh grade, the stomata? And combine them with sunlight and water from the earth up through the roots, and through the miracle of photosynthesis, spin that into sugar and form the beginning of the food chain. So for all of the earth's history, that photosynthesis and the exhaled breath of all the animals have existed in a kind of balance. But 150 years ago, when we exhumed the cemeteries of Devonian animals and plants in this unholy trinity of fossil fuels, oil, coal, and gas, and we lit those bodies on fire in crematoria that we call power plants, We loaded up our atmosphere with 40% more CO2 than pre-industrial levels and almost triple the amount of methane. So now at night, we have many more dancing, vibrating molecules, and it's like a blanket that we can't kick off. And the consequences, as you know, involve melting ice caps, rising seas, and of course the acidification of the ocean, because CO2 turns into carbonic acid when it falls into ocean water. Our plankton stocks are now in trouble because of rising acidity levels and also because of rising surface temperatures of the ocean. Phytoplankton provide us half of the oxygen in our atmosphere. Land plants provide the other half. And so one out of every two breaths we breathe is brought to us by the world's plankton. And if the plankton are in trouble, my friends, we are in trouble as well. And if you're hearing the science for the first time, then that's a failure of my field. If you hear about the falling Dow industrial stocks, but not about the plankton stocks and how they're doing, ask why we have a public conversation about economic stocks, but not about ecological stocks.
We heard there an edited extract of Sandra Steingraber's keynote address to the Permanent People's Tribunal Session on Human Rights, Fracking and Climate Change, held in May 2018. The tribunal held its hearings at Oregon State University in the US. Recordings of the tribunal and submissions made to it from around the world can be found at www.tribunalonfracking.org. You've been listening to Earth Matters, Community Radio's National Environmental Justice Program. I'm Tishan Ahern. If you missed any of today's show, you can find our podcasts at 3cr.org.au/Earth Matters. Earth Matters would like to thank the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial support and the Community Radio Network for getting the program out to you. Earth Matters is produced in the studios of 3CR in Melbourne on Wurundjeri country. If you'd like to get in contact, you can send us an email at earthmatters3cr@gmail.com or go to our Facebook page. I hope you can tune in next time for more Earth Matters.
By my darling, your eyes Hello and welcome to It's a Gay Area on 2SER 107.3. My name is Patrick and I'm here with my co-host,
Ruby.
That's Ruby, and we're so excited.
We are so excited. It feels like someone is punching my chest in the chest with their fist.
It does feel like that. This is our very first show, you guys. I know. We've just been screaming in the studio for literally since 1 p.m.
Yeah. Oh, boy, did I get here early. Actually, I didn't get here early. I got to a cafe across the road early and proceeded to drink two large coffees, which amounts to four shots of coffee.
And then you lost your tobacco pouch. And it's very sad.
Yeah, sad. I also ate what I thought was a bacon and scrambled egg wrap. Turns out it was not a bacon and it said on the sign bacon and scrambled egg wrap. And I was like, go off, honey. Right? Go off.
Go off.
And I later realized that it was just scrambled egg and also some spinach. And I was like, look, bacon's not that good for you anyway.
It's
so
not.
Totally fine.
But enough about our dietary requirements and neuroses. We are here to talk to you about gay things, everything queer. So basically, what we're doing today, it's our first show. We are talking about coming out.
It only seems to fit that we talk about coming out when we're coming out for our very first show.
Our very first show. So, like, we're here for the next half hour. We've got you till 8 o'clock. We've got you hostage. You can't leave us now.
Yeah, sorry about it.
Sorry.
So sorry about that. You can't leave. It's just so, like, try clicking on another channel. You won't. Don't actually try that.
Please don't leave us. I am just joking.
It's all jokes here. So this is It's a Gay Area with Patrick Clancy and Ruby Innes on 2SCR 107.3. Do you want to explain what's going to be happening on the show tonight?
We are going to have a very special guest on.
Yeah.
Talking about coming out experiences.
Yeah, we'll be joined by Blake Wilson, a.k.a. Honey Boy, who is a queer performance artist, and he will be coming to talk about his performance art as well as coming out. And we'll be talking about coming out because it's all about coming out on this episode. So it's, you know, going to be about, you know, what, like, can everybody come out? Like, the issue of outing. Like how coming out is kind of a thing for you and not for someone else to do for you, essentially. Mm-hmm.
We're just going to be having a really fun time with you guys. We're very excited. Please be nice to us.
Oh, God, please. It is our first show. Please be nice to us.
I've eaten nothing for 13 days.
Yes.
I have.
I have eaten so much for 13 days. Very specifically.
Basically, we've been doing the opposite of a fast.
Yeah, a slow. A slow.
I'm leaving the studio. So we're also going to...
We'll be playing some hot tunes
for you tonight. We don't have a lot of time, but so we've picked out two of the best ones.
Yeah, we'll be playing one from now. Not exactly right now. It didn't come out right now, but it did come out this year, and we'll also be playing a bit of an anthem.
And I will give you $14,000 if you can guess what the Golden
Oldie is. You cannot promise people money that we do not have, Patrick. We're not doing that.
You don't know
that
my
is
finances.
Not what's happening. But
if you are from the ATO, I don't have that.
What we'll be trying to do every episode, as well as having a topic for every episode, this topic being coming out, we're going to be playing a new song from an LGBTQI plus artist, as well as a well-known gay anthem, because we do only have our half-hour slot.
So we only want to give you the best.
Yeah, we got to give you something old, something new, something blue.
Yeah, the blue things matter for my doctor.
Oh,
I don't
sad.
Want to talk about them there.
Oh, sad.
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 So, do we want to kick off with the song now?
Yeah!
Let's do that.
Yeah.
So,
this one's been described as a rock opera fantasy and also been described as a response to the hashtag Me Too movement and transphobia in Hollywood.
What a tune.
Yeah, it came
already.
Came out June. And it's the debut single from Love Bailey, featuring BB Huxley and Edward Vigiletti. What's it called, Patrick?
It is called Hollywood Hooker. And also, just for general, a language warning.
Yeah, a bit of a language warning on this one. You are listening to It's a Gay Area with Patrick Clancy and Ruby Innes on 2SER 107.3.
She's a looker, Hollywood hooker.
Think we can book her?
Hollywood hooker.
Honey, this show don't come for free. Savage ranch from dusk till dawn. I click my heels and the beat goes on. Let's go, boys.
Slather it up.
Are we back?
We're back.
We're back. I'm sorry when you did this, guys. Please forgive our sins.
You are listening to It's a Gay Area on 2SER 107.3.
With me, Patrick.
And me, Ruby.
And now we have someone else in the studio.
We do have someone else in the studio, but before we introduce that someone else in the studio...
Oh, I'm sorry.
That was Hollywood Hooker by Love Bailey featuring Bebe Huxley and Edward Vigiletti. I quite liked it. I love that song and I love Love Bailey.
I love Love Bailey too.
It's just like there's this very strong, terrifying essence that comes from Love Bailey that I am all about.
If you want more of that essence, go watch the music video for Honeywood, Honeywood Hooker.
Hookerwood Holly.
Hookerwood Holly.
Hobble up, bubba.
I'm going to have a
The rest of this radio show will only be in Simlish. Thank you. Whipsy Bonica Do. I'm sorry, I'll stop.
Oh, my God. Watch the music video.
Look, I just got to be honest, but every one of the Sims games is kind of like detrimental to gay culture.
It is.
Am I wrong? I'm not wrong.
It makes every queer person in the world stay inside.
stay inside.
I know.
So... not on that note, because it's completely unrelated to what we'll be going into. We are now joined in the studio by queer performance artist Blake Wilson, a.k.a. Honey Boy. Thank you so much for joining us, Blake.
Thanks for having me, Ruby.
You're so welcome.
I just want to say I've just met Blake, and I already love him. He's amazing. Oh,
so Blake is just an essence, an incredible essence. You may not be able to see him... But here's an essence. There's, like, so much going on right here that I'm just all about. If you go on our Twitter, you'll be able to see the essence of Blake. He's looking fantastic.
But we promise we do have real questions and
we
real opinions.
We do have
opinions
absolutely real questions.
Just you complimenting me for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's just... I don't hate it, though. We could just compliment it for 20 minutes.
Well, let's just start with something to get you a little bit warmed up. How's your day been, Blake?
I've been in bed all day.
Amazing.
Yeah, I made myself lunch and that was pretty much the highlight, but it was really good.
I'm jealous.
Yeah, I really wish that was what I was doing.
If any of you guys were listening, I was on breakfast here at 2SER at 6:45 promoing this show.
Yeah.
My co-host was not with me.
Okay, I had uni. That's not fair. I had a tutorial that I had to go to. And you know what I did at that tutorial? I had a big rant about how there's life on in other... okay, so...
Get learned.
No, you know what? I'm not going to go because we are supposed to be doing an interview. I will pop off about life in the universe.
Listen
much
to the
later.
Extended podcast later for that.
All right, so let's pop off. How did you get into performance art?
I just kind of jumped right in there. I always thought I wanted to do it, but it was like, that's like a really scary thing. Like, I always thought performance artists, people were just like, I'm like covered in bags and now I'm running up to you. And I was like, that's stressful. I don't want to be in that at all. but part of me was like, there's like a lot of power in that and like power in the audience. I found drag as an easier way to get into that. Like, it's less scary than like other types of performance art, I find, because it's like there's more of like a routine. It's like there's a song, I'm lip syncing, and then it's kind of over.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the first, like, not the first drag I've seen, the first performance art I've seen was a video of this woman in an art gallery screaming and shoving baked beans, language warning, up a hoochie. And it was the most terrible. And people were just sitting in the audience like, wow.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
Capitalism.
Hoochie. I know. Hoochie. And the sad... I've seen that. I definitely have seen that one.
Yeah, like, I saw that and I'm like, so that's what performance art is. And that's just, like, always been in my mind since... But, you know, performance art is obviously so much more than putting baked beans in your hoochie.
Or is it?
Or is it?
Or is it?
So speaking of that, Blake, if your performance art does not involve shoving baked beans, where baked beans should truthfully not be, what does your performance art involve?
So mine's more of like a drag kind of performance work. So I normally have like music, but it's not always with... vocals that much. Like, sometimes it's just a bit of screaming and, like, I'm there. So maybe it is a bit, like, scary performance art.
I mean, yes. Speaking personally, I'm not having fun until someone is screaming at me.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just the constant mood.
I think you're my crowd then. Like, I need you in the crowd just waiting for me to scream.
I honestly only listen to music that's screaming. And I don't mean, like, screamo. That was me when I was 15. I'm more into just, like, guttural screeching with only one cello in the background. Okay. My music taste is... Yeah.
One cello with one broken string.
Yeah.
So sad.
But I normally do kind of clownish kind of makeup. Like, clown's a real vibe of my artist, like, all my art.
Yeah.
Just somehow got clowns in
it. I mean, I'm looking at the makeup now and it is beautiful. And I can't do that.
It is
and
clowny
it makes me sad.
And beautiful.
Again, go to our Twitter. There is a photo. And it's great.
What is it about clowns that kind of, I don't know, stuck with you?
I think, honestly, at first I was just like, clowns are so freaky. This is hilarious. And well, part of it is like the duality of them being like, oh, you think of clowns as like these comedians and like, oh, they're always surrounded by like laughter and happiness, but also like sometimes I'm in depressive episodes. So it's like this duality of like being like presentable, happy, and also being like depressed. And then I found like thinking about it and using it in my work more, like, it relates to, well, I feel like it relates to me and, like, trans people as, like, sometimes people see trans people as, like, either, like, a joke, like, they're funny, or, like, scared, like, oh, you're going to hurt my children. And I think it kind of relates to clowns, like, clowns are scary and funny.
Yeah.
And also I just love the, like, freakish aesthetic of them and how it relates to, like, freak show culture and how that is, like, othered bodies, and it all just kind of ties in into me being a clown, I think.
Yeah. Cool.
I love that.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. I'm crying. I don't know why I'm crying in the studio right now.
So what was your first performance about, like your very first performance?
It ties in with this week's theme really well. So
that may not be what I was planning.
So I did it was for like a textiles class, but I did this work where I got like a kind of closet and I smashed it up with an axe and like kind of brought it back together with shoelaces and lace, and so I could kind of wear it as this heavy closet thing. And on it I put like harassment, like people on Instagram being like, you're fucked up, like you're female, and like someone like yelled shemale at me, so I put that in lace. But then I wore it and it was called The Closet Comes With Me. And actually, because the whole thing was about like how you're always coming out, like it's not one experience, but it like I didn't realize how heavy it actually was. So it was like physically, like I was like trying to perform in it, and it was really heavy. But yeah, so I wore that and I had an axe and I performed to a song by Seb DeLisa called Human.
Ooh.
It was really scary.
You know what? I remember you telling me about that, and I actually listened to that song after we had our chat, and that is a great song.
Yeah.
It is fantastic.
Another great music video. She's like got horse legs.
It is
spoiler.
I'm
wild.
Here. I can't watch it now because I know there's horse legs and I'm terrified of them. So in sort of going with coming out, do you think it's as relevant now as it was, say, 10, 20 years ago?
I still think it kind of is, but I think people are pushing towards it, or not pushing, just it's kind of going towards like it not being as a big deal. Like people are always saying like, oh, like if it's National Coming Out Day or something, which is the day I came out. it's like, oh, like hopefully there'll be a day where we like don't have to come out, which I like kind of get as in like, oh, we're all human. But I'm also like, I still think there's an importance of that, of like being like, okay, we're living in a world that's like mainly kind of cis hetero people, and yeah. I'm like trans or I'm queer. I still think there's like a lot of value and importance in the act of like coming out.
Mm. Why do you think like some people feel the need to come out while others don't?
I think sometimes it relates to like safety. Like some people are like, oh, be true to yourself. Like, but sometimes you can't come out because like you could get fired or you could get like kicked out of your house or, but also, like, some people, it's just not as much as a big deal. Like, I kind of came out as trans. I'm like, hey, I'm trans. But just, like, was like, oh, and I'm queer. Like, it was like, that's old news, guys. Like, I didn't feel the need to do a big thing about that. But maybe that's because being trans is, like, that.
It's
me sighing.
It is. Yeah, no, I totally understand. Did anything really change for you after you came out as trans?
I mean, yeah.
like other than the obvious things, you know, like, yeah. Like I guess, like just, like, in your surroundings and stuff.
Yeah, I think it took a while. Like, it wasn't like, oh, hey, I'm out as trans, and it was like my whole life was different. It was like with family and with friends even, it was like people take time to kind of get used to that change. Like, my parents only... My dad recently called me he for the first time, and I've been, like, out as trans for, like, 2-ish years.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's changed, but it's taken, like, 2 years for that to change. But, yeah.
That's a big moment. It's really nice.
High five.
Oh, that rules. That freaking rules, bro. I'm not crying. Oh, that's great. Well, how do you think in your experience, how do you think the kind of, like, drag industry, the performance art industry treats trans artists?
Well, I think they're definitely more kind of accepted than they are in a lot of other industries, because, like, drag, even though a lot of people see it as, like, a gay man dressing up as, like, a woman. I wish you could see me doing air quotes through the radio.
A woman.
But even, like, though that's, like, a kind of normative idea of what drag is, it's still, like, a lot more accepted to be trans or queer. But I guess in all industries there's, like, tokenism of that as well. Like, oh, look at this trans person we have. But, like, do we really care about that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing. And saying, like, when I first not saying, like, when I first started going to drag shows and going to things like that, there was all, like, and this was only a couple of years ago, I was like, oh, this is gay men dressing up as women. That's what drag is.
Yeah.
And that is so wrong. It is not correct.
Yeah, no, I was, like, once of the belief that, like, purely because of the culture, only cis gay men are allowed to do drag. And, like, literally it was, like, late last year that I was like, that's not it. Brain fixed now. No, but, like, yeah, drag is so much more than just what you see on RuPaul's Drag Race. And personally took me a while to figure that out.
Yeah, I think it's a lot more about performance than gender.
Yeah.
Which people don't always get. And sometimes it's about performing gender, but, yeah.
So have you got any performances coming up?
Oh, lucky you asked, Ruby.
That's so crazy that you asked that right now.
Yeah, I'm part of a performance night. It's on the 25th of August. And if you look up Sample Sydney Intersex Space, it's there on Facebook. It's right there. But it's like a collective of different performance artists, and it's got a real focus on, like, experimental performance. So I'm really excited because I'm doing a kind of durational piece that I haven't done before, because normally I just do, like, under drag, but now it's like a longer period of time.
It's gonna be 4 hours long.
Yeah.
And it's just gonna be you screaming. My life. Baked beans. Okay, so that is all we have time for. Thank you so much for joining us, Blake.
Thanks. Thank you.
And this is It's a Gay Area on 2SER 107.3.
We just had Blake Wilson, a.k.a. Honey Boy, on.
And the police are coming to drag away Ruby because she's lost her mind.
Yeah, my brain broken. It's
brain
okay.
Broken.
Just think, if my brain weren't broken, would I be so funny and interesting? Probably not. Ha 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 ha. Every brain broken, which is funny.
So this is how I came out.
Let's talk about that. Absolutely. So now we're going to talk a bit about the coming out experience, what we think about coming out. But let's start with Patrick's coming out story.
Patrick, that's me. So first of all, I just got to clarify this. Like, I have a very narrow perspective, really, on coming out. I am a cis, white, gay man. That's, like, a lot of people.
You are.
I am. That's me, and that's the tea. I came out, I'd say, when I was, like, 15 in year 9, fresh off the high school oval playing sports. But, like, I just, like, I remember one night it was, like, I had a dream. I can't remember what that dream was about now. Something gay. But I had a gay-ish dream. And then I started crying in the morning because I was like,
woke up in a cold sweat. I'm gay!
Literally what happened. I woke up, I was crying, I went out to the living room, and I told my mum, Mum, I think I'm gay. And Mum was like, okay. And I believe Mum's listening tonight. Thank you, Mum. You were very nice to me.
Patrick said, Mum, I'm gay. And she said, I named you Patrick. Mum jokes exist too, guys. That's what equality is. Mum jokes are valid. Mum jokes are valid, absolutely.
But yeah, my coming out to my family was pretty good. I got my mum to tell my dad and my brother, I think. My sister's pretty smart. She did it on her own. The rest of them, dumb. No, I'm kidding. I love you guys. And then I came out. So that was to my family. I came out at school, I'd say. Like, right now, I'm just, like, out to anyone who meets me. Like, it's pretty obvious. But, like, when I was at school, first I came out, I was having some waffles when I was skipping a maths class. Because I don't like maths.
Sad.
So I was skipping class. I was getting some waffles with some friends. There was one who was a pretty good friend, and the other one I didn't really know that well, but I liked her. She was nice. Mm. And then that the girl who I didn't know that well, just like, oh, are you gay? And I was like, because I'm a very fundamentally good human being, and I never lie. Yeah. So I went, yes, but please don't tell anyone. Aww. And then I went on life from that point. I don't believe she told anyone.
I wonder what triggered that. Just like, I don't know, she saw the way you were eating the waffle or something. She's like, that's a pretty gay way to eat a waffle.
Oh, bro.
Oh, bro, you're eating that waffle awfully gaily. I really want that to become like a verb, like gaily.
Gaily. But yeah, so then I came out to my friends in a Jenga game when one of them was like, oh, do you watch gay things? And I was like, what?
That's so weird. Telling me that. I'm like, that's odd. That's an odd way to do the thing, you know?
And I said, yes. And then they told me they already knew because that girl who I said asked not to tell people had
She told people. That's cooked.
Yeah,
oh, my God.
Also, so, fun fact, don't out people. Not nice.
Just don't out people. It's not that hard.
If you know someone's gay but they're not out, keep it to yourself.
Keep it to yourself. And on that note, we're going to have to sign off because it is nearing our end time.
It is nearing 8 o'clock, which is at the time Ruby shuts down because she is a robot.
I am. I only have batteries for half an hour. Beep, boop. Just want to say a big thank you to our producer, Lou.
She's been sitting in the studio the whole time. She's not allowed to talk.
Yeah.
Also, if you look at her tweets, they're amazing and very manic, and we love that.
Yep. Do you want to tell lovely viewers, you're looking at this right now, your viewers, what next week's theme will be?
Next week's theme will be representation in media, film, poetry.
Whatever you feel like thinking about.
Wherever you feel like you should be represented, we'll talk about it.
We will. We're going to talk about that. Next up is Hardcore Classic with Danny. It's going to be some real good Hardcore Classic stuff.
Ruby is shutting down.
I am shutting down.
Before we go, we're going to give you our golden oldie. That sounds bad.
This week's golden oldie fits the theme. You are listening to It's a Gay Area on 2SER 107.3 with Patrick and Ruby. This is I'm Coming Out by Diana Ross.
Bye.
Bye.